Welcome, folks, to Film Strips, the podcast that, well, just can't seem to get its way out of, you know, territory that we're probably not qualified to talk about. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Carnegie, sir. How you doing, Dave?
Ah, like I said, I'm feeling all right. I had a Red Bull about 4 hours ago, and I'm still running off of that, so it's a rare thing for me to have Red Bull, but, yeah.
So on the heels of a sick episode and the heels of an exhausted episode, now we have a hyper-caffeinated Dave episode.
Hooray! But yes, so once again, this is the podcast that is about a film each week, but somehow the film we discuss in any given episode has to connect back to the episode that immediately preceded it. So, Andrew, what were we taking a look at last week?
Last week, we were looking at... What were we looking at last week, David? I guess it's my turn.
It was In the Heat of the Night.
Oh, yes. In the Heat of the Night. I think that goes to say just how well I think that episode went. But yeah, so... And David, you were the one who came up with the connection, because yes. I remember it was somebody that I had never heard of taking us to a film that I was excited about until I realized it was the sequel.
Yes. So last week we had, in a very minor performance, Matt Clark showing up as the guy who tells Mr. Tibbs how to find the abortionist, or where to find the abortionist.
And oh, yeah. It's,
that's right. So from there, Matt Clark has gone on, you know, we'll jump ahead to 1995's Candyman Farewell to the Flesh, Bill Condon's sequel to the 1992 cult classic Candyman.
Yes, the middle child of the Candyman family.
Well, you say that, but I think most of us pretend Candyman 3 didn't happen. From the sounds of it, Tony Todd views it that way as well. But yes, we are taking a look at Candyman, Farewell to the Flesh, directed by Bill Condon, based, much like the first film, off the story by Clive Barker, The Forbidden, and starring Tony Todd, Kelly Rowan, William O'Leary, Bill Nunn, Veronica Cartwright, Matt Clark, Joshua Gibran Mayweather, Faye Hauser, David Giannopoulos, and the voice of Russell Buchanan. We'll get to there eventually. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, Candyman. Now, for the uninitiated, I guess, Candyman's kind of one of those sleeper franchises, you know? Because when we think back about sort of the great horror arcs, maybe great should be in air quotes there, but you've got your Friday the 13th franchise. You have your Nightmare on Elm Street. You have, you know, sort of the heavy hitters. And over time, there's, you know, changes in cultural attitudes or what we find scary or just diminishing quality of the films themselves. But they're kind of like the mainstays. And then there are sort of the one-and-dones that never go anywhere. And yet Candyman seems to occupy this weird, weird little gap where every now and then they go back to that well. And it never seems like it hugely crossed over into, like, popular consciousness the way that Jason Voorhees or Michael Myers have, but he's always kind of just there as soon as he's summoned, in a way. And I'm wondering, Dave, could you fill us in a bit on Candyman?
Well, as I said at the start of the episode here, this is the origins of Candyman rest with one Clive Barker. And for those of you unfamiliar with Clive Barker, he is a writer and artist and filmmaker who got his start writing a series of books that at least got him noticed called The Books of Blood, which were the six-volume series published throughout the 1980s, collecting Barker's rather out-there horror fiction. Particularly at the time, Barker was definitely paving some new ground, and he would eventually go on to do so in film with the 1987 classic Hellraiser, which I think many people are probably most familiar with in terms of his work.
Yeah, certainly some of the most iconic images. And even now that I think about saying it out loud, yeah, like Candyman kind of plays second fiddle to Clive Barker's real monster, which is Pinhead.
Yeah, which, again, is funny given that Barker had never intended Pinhead to become the iconic figure he was. That just sort of incidentally ended up happening. But neither here nor there. So if you've read the Books of Blood stories, a large number of them have been adapted into films over the years, such as films, again, as Rawhead Rex.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
and,
which...
Lord of Illusion?
Lord of Illusions was, yeah, based off The Last Illusion from, I believe, the final volume is the one it was published in. Eventually, The Midnight Meat Train was turned into a film, which me and James discussed back on the old Cinema Chase podcast.
Yes, you did.
But, yes, keep that that title in mind there, folks. But, I mean, it's also now apparently, I guess, in development to become an anthology horror show as well now.
Well, there's a lot of content there. For those of you who haven't read it, it's stylistically, it's sort of all over the place because it's very dark, it's very nightmarish, and then he has like quintessentially British comedy shorts about demons that move into, you know, just middle-class families' houses. But yeah, like Barker, though, I mean, every horror creator, though, they sort of have their go-to. And it seems with Barker, he's very concerned with the idea of the other as a form of something that is repressed. In a lot of his work, it's sort of body consciousness. It definitely has that Cronenbergian sort of influence. But the big two are sexuality and race, and sort of the intertwining of that otherness versus how the monster in horror is always figured as some kind of other.
See, the thing is, I would definitely agree with you about sexuality. I'm not entirely sure about race, at least in terms of Barker's overall body of work. Because as we'll get into, the short story that this film is based, that the first Candyman is based off of, The Forbidden, was a British set text. And again, having gone through the short story again, there's nothing that I can honestly stands out in my mind, and I'm willing to completely admit, maybe I totally missed something here, folks. So please call me out if I'm wrong on this. But I don't get any sense that the idea of racial othering is part and parcel of that tale. It's simply set amongst the working class or impoverished classes of British society.
Okay, fair point there, and I sort of misspoke. It's more that by the time Candyman comes to the screen, though,
yeah,
that's where it happens. So it's not necessarily in Barker's work, but what we end up getting out of this franchise is horror explicitly linked to race.
Yeah, because what ends up happening is Bernard Rose, the British filmmaker, ends up adapting Barker's tale, but what he ends up deciding to do is reset it in Chicago for the 1992's Candyman, starring Virginia Madison and Tony Todd. And for those who haven't seen that film, and right off the bat we should note here, spoilers for both that movie, because we have to acknowledge them, and spoilers for this film as well. So if you want to check out and go see these movies now, probably the best point to do it is check out at this point and then come back to us. But the initial Candyman is a film about a white woman, an academic, who is investigating, or at least doing her thesis on urban legends and how they get started. And what ends up happening is she comes across in, is it Cabrini Green, if I'm not mistaken?
Cabrini Green, the housing project.
Yeah, ends up being, she comes across the artwork and stories about this figure called the Candyman, something that is, from what she's theorizing, is at least some sort of figure that everybody's sort of pinning the horrible things that happen in the community on, as rather than dealing with it. And from there, of course, in typical horror fashion, she comes to discover that there's more to it than it initially seems to be the case, because after more or less denying the existence of the Candyman and trying to convince his quote-unquote worshippers that live within this project that the Candyman doesn't really exist, he decides to make an example of her. And the film follows from there as she finds her life torn apart by this mythical entity, which may simply be a form of fear or belief given life by people's fear and belief.
Yeah, and that's one of the more interesting threads of the first Candyman film, because by the time I first saw it, I sort of knew it by reputation, and I thought it sounded kind of hokey and dumb, and it ends up being a very shrewd film. And I think, like, it's it definitely outperforms its budget and its limitations. But one of the coolest aspects is it does really tackle that idea of, does belief in things, both positive and negative forces, is that what brings them to life? Does it exist outside of us? And sort of in trying to pursue and understand these monsters, is that what's making them real?
Yeah, and what the way in which Rose tackles this, ends up being more fascinating by the fact that, yes, he ends up setting it within a particularly Black American context, in that the origins of the Candyman is as a brutalized Black man who was basically murdered by a lynch mob over 100 years prior, and whose, you know, the details of his death have given birth to this idea of him as this vengeful spirit with a hook for a hand and bees which come out of his mouth over time. And Tony Todd plays the character. And what's also interesting about it is the fact that the way in which the film is structured, and once again, as usual, we should point out for the record, podcast hosted by two white male Canadians, keep that in mind.
Standard qualifier.
Yeah. Is the fact that what the film is interesting about the film is that, again, Virginia Madison's character, Helen, is the figure we follow throughout that movie. And there's very much the film has this fascinatingly sustained criticism of academia throughout it, in the sense that we have this white woman going into Black spaces to comment upon their culture or these people's lived experience, and doing it for her, whether career-wise or financially, for her personal gain.
Yeah, in there. She has that academic detachment to everything, at least at first. So
yeah,
it's like it's not a threat because she experiences that a remove. Like especially in the early part of the film, it's like Candyman is something that they believe. Candyman might be a force that's terrorizing them.
Yeah, and there's tons of clever little play about the idea of how there seems to be this status and division in terms of Helen from the people who live in Cabrini Green, and how she sort of tries to maintain that distance and that sort of class distinction that really plays into how she behaves and feels, and also motivates her as she gets frustrated with the latent misogyny and of her male colleagues in the academic fields.
I was going to say, it must be frustrating to be married to Xander Berkeley for that long.
Yes. And of course, you know, the film, like I say, it's a very smart, very unconventional film in that way, in terms of that it's choosing to deal with very loaded subject matter, basically by design, feels like it's tailor-made for the kind of academic analysis that, well, academics love to bring to these kinds of films, and yet is also a sustained attack, basically, upon that kind of academic mindset as well. Not to mention, Bernard Rose does not make that film in a conventional sense. Or at least the form and style of that film is not conventional. There's probably most notably, it has a score by Philip Glass, who I think many people, if you know his name, is probably from the fact his classical and operatic works, such as Einstein on the Beach, which if you haven't listened to, it's a doozy. I think that's safe to put it.
Yeah, it's like a slightly less party-fied version of the Koyaanisqatsi Kwatsi score. Or however it is you say it.
Yeah, and then, of course, he's had some mainstream work. He co-wrote the score for the Josh Trank version of the Fantastic Four. I have no idea how that happened to the state. But yeah, I mean, there's so many little editing touches in that about that first Candyman that mark it as a very unique project within American horror film, particularly American horror film of the early 90s.
Yeah, there's very little that you can say it has in common with other cinema, just period. And to that point, like, it's also a film that doesn't necessarily resolve itself so neatly, because overtly, like, we see her become the newest manifestation of the monster, in a sense, but, like, it remains at that level of abstractness where the question of belief versus, you know, the external monster that still kind of remains unresolved. And in that regard, though, it's like, do we need to make a sequel to that film? And on top of that, do we need a sequel that then grounds these elements of the mythos to make the Candyman into a concrete figure?
Well, and this is the thing, because following the surprise success of the film in 1992, there is an immediate press push to start to making a sequel to it. Now, Bernard Rose, who adapted Barker's short story and wrote the first film, apparently wrote a draft of the script that was suggested and rejected. And from what director Bill Condon has said, even though he admits he hasn't had an opportunity to read that script, what it actually was an adaptation of Midnight Meat Train, as opposed to a straight-ahead sequel featuring the figure of the Candyman, which makes it sound like basically Rose was approaching this more as a thematic sequel than a narrative sequel. This did not end up being made, obviously, and Rose was not part of the further development. Instead, we end up having screenwriters Rand Ravitch and Mark Kruger come on board. Now, from what I understand, they did not work together, but worked successively for one another, and ambiguously from the credits of the film, it's hard to tell whether Clive Barker originated the story for the sequel itself, or whether the way the credits are phrased, they simply mean that it's based upon his original short story.
I give a lot of credence to Rand Ravitch, because going on to write The Astronaut's Wife, it showed that making poor retreads of better horror films is kind of in his wheelhouse.
But certainly we should also acknowledge that Barker is a executive producer on both films, so he, from the sounds of it, did have a fair bit of say on both of the first two Candyman films, to at least some degree.
Yeah, and Barker certainly is also, he's not a Stephen King figure, but by 1995, he's a name that carries a certain amount of cachet with it.
Yeah. Now, in the process of developing this film, eventually it comes down to, well, who's going to direct it? And while there were apparently a few possible choices, the individual that ultimately ends up being selected is Bill Condon. Now, you might be familiar with that name these days, because he was the director behind Oscar winner, or one of the Oscar nominated and winning films, Gods and Monsters from 1998, and has gone on in the years since to direct a wide variety of films, such as Dreamgirls,
Better than it has any right to be. Plus, we get to see Eddie Murphy rapping.
Yeah, and we get Mr. Holmes, starring Ian McKellen, and probably most recently, and most familiar, that people I think would be most familiar with, is his take on Beauty and the Beast, the Disney animated version done in live action. There's also something about directing some Twilight films that we're going to just push to the side for now.
Yeah, the two where nothing happens.
So, how is that any different than the films that preceded them?
Valid point. Eclipse stands out in the series only because it's the one where things of consequence occur. Yeah, so, I mean, Condon, he seems like a pretty adaptable director.
Yeah, and from all accounts, he is a bit of a genre nut. He likes horror films. He got to start working as a screenwriter. I believe he co-wrote the 80s film Strange Invaders, a sort of love letter to 1950s sci-fi films. And certainly he's been attached to directing a remake of Bride of Frankenstein before the whole Universal Dark Universe plans all collapsed around him. So he's not without his horror credit, but the thing about Condon and what he openly admits is that the reason he kind of directed this movie was twofold. One, he really admired what Bernard Rose had done on the first movie, but two, at this point in time in his career, he had basically been locked out of any sort of feature filmmaking and had been stuck working in made-for-TV and made-for-cable films. Again, happens to the best of filmmakers. So for him, Candyman 2 was kind of something that he took on with the notion of it being something of a sort of sure bet to at least make something of a profit off of it.
And I think given sort of where he was in his career and sort of that stigma he felt on himself, whether or not the industry agreed, I think that may be what motivates the better aspects of this film, probably like aiming higher a little bit to show I can do more than just make TV movies. Or maybe it's just because those are the moments where he feels, well, here's where I should be a lot more faithful to the original. Because, yeah, it's not a film without its charm. And, I mean, certainly movies like Kinsey that Condon would go on later to make, he shows that he's a pretty cerebral guy. So it's just strange to me to look at his career and realize, well, 20 years ago, people thought, okay, well, you can be a decent screenwriter when we need something schlocky, and that's the best you're going to do.
Yeah, and you really do feel like... The thing that we will say about this, and I think just to tip our hands about Candyman, Farewell to the Flesh right off the bat, or at least from my perspective, the film we're discussing, I think, is actually a reasonably good movie. And a reasonably good horror film. But it just has the misfortune of being the follow-up to a great one preceding it.
Yeah. It's, I mean, and we were discussing earlier, I'm like, I'm kind of two minds because, you know, you can't, it's like Jerry Lee Lewis lighting his piano on fire. How do you follow that, you know? And this film certainly tries, but I think also in trying, it overreaches at some points, and that makes the film a lot more problematic than I think it intends to be.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And, I mean, certainly one of the things I will give Condon credit for as well, for those who've listened to the commentary track, which is featured on the recent Blu-ray release from the Shout Factory, which was also apparently, I guess, recorded in the early 2000s, based upon the comments he was making. Condon is
comments
not...
like what? I'd love to make Dream Girls one day.
Well, a lot of his comments sort of reflect the idea that, you know, this is right at the starting of the DVD revolution, okay, sort of thing, and talk about where it's like, okay, some time has passed since then. But the thing I will say about Condon is, you know, he is pretty frank about the film in the sense that he is not overly defensive about it or trying to make it out to be any better than it is. He acknowledges it's a flawed movie and that, yeah, mistakes were made in the process, and some of it was motivated by, as you're even acknowledging here, Andrew, the idea of feeling pressure to prove what he can do. Certainly, he acknowledges some of the jump scares throughout the film. He knows that they were put in there by him to sort of prove to the executives in charge that, yes, I can make a horror film, and that, in hindsight, those really shouldn't have been there.
There's one in particular that I would like to get to a bit later on.
Yeah, well, I think that once we get into the nitty-gritty here, that's certainly going to be the case. But I guess speaking of getting into the nitty-gritty, we should actually probably describe what this film's actually about. So, Andrew, given my very brief synopsis of the first film, as lacking in detail as it was, what is the story of Candyman 2?
Your absence of detail, Dave, is most people's master's thesis. So Candyman 2, it follows a different set of characters. In this case, we're following Annie, who's played by Kelly Rowan. She is a school teacher in the New Orleans area, but, you know, there's more than meets the eye, because not only does she have a wealthy and very melodramatic family, but she also gets twigged to the idea of the Candyman, both what some of her students, she teaches an inner city school group, mostly young black men, which we'll also get to, but she learns of the Candyman story from them, and also it turns out that her father disappeared and then died while searching for the Candyman. So she gets drawn into the mystery, and all of this coincides with, well, it's set in New Orleans, so we have to get a requisite section of Mardi Gras. So these threads kind of come together, and next thing she knows, her brother is being held in jail, accused of crimes that the Candyman committed, and she ends up going to find out everything she can about the Candyman's history, trying to look for the one way to stop him and finally put an end to his menace.
So, based on that plot description, you're probably sitting there saying, well, that doesn't sound too out of the ordinary for a horror sequel. And you're not wrong. It isn't that out of the ordinary, which is part of the problem in some ways, because compared to the structure of the first film and what goes on in that movie. Candyman 2 is a bit more conventional in terms of its story structure, in terms of the beats it hits, and yes, in terms of how it tries to scare the audience. But that's not necessarily a flaw that the film can't compensate for, is it, Andrew?
It's not. And on the one hand, like, this film makes itself pretty clear that it's not interested in staying abstract, more so in the sense of the narrative. Like, it's pretty clearly signposting where it's going at all times, and sort of focuses itself around those threads. Because aside from, like, the opening bit and our first real jump scare of Candyman's first kill, again, of an academic type who summons him because he doesn't believe in him.
Which people... also, we should note, is one of the only other character who reappears from the first movie.
I thought so, okay? Yeah. I'm like, yeah, fat Englishman with bad hair. Something triggered my memories there. But aside from that, like, we're mostly focused on the character of Annie, both as the story's main character and our point of identification. So we're pretty much following her for most of it. And at the same time, every moment that it could slightly be unclear what we're supposed to be feeling going into the scene, it continually refers back to these interstitials featuring Kingfisher, the local DJ, who seems to be more of like a revival-style preacher, talking about everything that the Easter holiday means to the people of New Orleans, and sort of speaking in this literal and subtextual sense at all times. Now, it doesn't work, because Kingfisher is terrible, even to the point where Condon admits that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like, this is a film that also... It sets up the stakes pretty quickly, as well, because we have the young woman with a missing father and a brother accused of a crime that he didn't commit. Whereas I feel like the narrative of the first Candyman film is a lot more amorphous, maybe just because it follows a character that's doing research and is investigative and speculative. Like, she's looking for Candyman because she wants to know. Whereas here, Annie is looking for the Candyman because she wants to stop him. And I think that places a different emphasis on how the story is told in both films.
Well, it's interesting, because you're absolutely right. The nature of the investigation and how it plays out is certainly different. At the same time, the film goes out of its way to really call attention to the similarities to the first film, because even though Kelly Rowan is unmistakably not Virginia Madison, the way this is a film about a younger blonde woman who happens to have a job either in or adjacent to the field of education, who ends up investigating this situation with the Candyman, and who either finds themselves friends and family becoming entangled with the authorities, who also happen to be looking into this rash of killings that seem to be going on around them. And the thing about it is, that sounds like the film is just a simple retread. And for the first third of it, I think it's very forgiving. You can be forgiven for thinking that, yeah, this is a less interesting retread of the first movie. But
yeah, it kind of feels like when the local bar band does a cover of a Beatles song, where it's like, well, you're hitting the notes, but it's just not quite the same.
Yeah, but the thing, I will give the credit to Ravitch and Kruger on this note. I think there is something clever about how they invite, and Condon's direction in casting the film, how it invites the audience to misidentify this film as a straight-ahead retread of the first movie. Because there is revelations about two-thirds of the way through this movie, which suddenly tips everything on its head in terms of the dynamic and relationship between Candyman and the Annie character. And I guess in order to explain what that is, we need to sort of go back and sort of get into what you're talking about, we're hinting at earlier, Andrew, which is what this film does to the Candyman mythos, as it were, compared to the first movie. Because as we sort of acknowledged, the first film, there is sort of a legend or history of who the Candyman was in real life at one point in time, prior to the events of this film. But that movie is very unclear as to whether the figure we're seeing in this movie is just a manifestation of belief, or if it actually is the spirit of this long-dead individual.
Well, it's also because the whole film sort of couches itself in the discourse of urban legends and sort of like that oral tradition of storytelling, especially amongst marginalized communities. There, it also invites the idea that, like, well, this is not necessarily the candy, like the historical figure it's based on, but it's somehow like a reiteration of that, or it's a variation on the story that's endured through time. Whereas in this movie, no, like, we end up establishing, again, like, I feel, yeah, it's not like a late reveal or anything, but we learn about midway through the film that, nope, Candyman is a real person, Daniel Robitaille, and I believe they specify that he was a freed slave at the time he was killed.
He was, yeah, from the, if I remember the exact details correctly, he was a reasonably well-off black gentleman from the north who was a painter, who was hired by this family to come and paint their portrait. In the process, he falls in love with the wealthy, or with the white woman, who is the wealthy daughter of a plantation owner. The resulting shock at the fact that when she becomes pregnant with his child results in her father leading, as we acknowledged earlier, a lynch mob to hunt down Robitaille, sever his hand with a rusted chain or hacksaw, smash open a honeycomb and slather his body with honey to attract the bees, who then proceed to sting him to death.
Yeah, it's when you say lynching, I mean,
yeah, lynching suggests
like that, but I mean, because they are brutal and unanswerable acts that form a large part of America's history. But what happens to Daniel seems to go even beyond that. Like, yeah, it is an act of cruelty, pure cruelty. And as he points out in the film, his only crime was falling in love with a woman. And for that, he had everything taken from him, and he was desecrated while still alive. Like, if you're trying to give a monster a motivation, I mean, that is definitely one. Though, I gotta say, though, that it's kind of weird, because especially by the time we sort of finally see that flashback at the end of the film, I think there's a real danger in making the monster of the film sympathetic. And the problem is that in the first film, if the first film was doing what this one does, I would say that's almost the point, where we blur the line between what is monstrous and what is just rejected by culture. But the problem is, once that's established, this film then becomes, I would say, its most conventional.
It does, and I have two minds of it, because the thing about it is, I mean, by making explicit that this is, you know, the spirit of this man who suffered unspeakable evil committed against him, it very much puts him in the mode of the sympathetic villain thing. This is the guy who, to be entirely honest, from a completely different perspective, is honestly could be read as a heroic figure here, because, you know, he has risen beyond this to achieve some form of immortality and in one shape or form, avenge himself in a more symbolic way against the culture of it did this to him. And part of me was almost suspecting that, yeah, what would end up happening with this film was that it would turn out that Annie's family was related to those who had committed this crime in the first place.
Well, yeah, and it's logical. It's like, if Candyman is like this sort of independent force, why is it that it happens to keep crossing paths with this woman and the people that she's close to?
Yeah. But, and the thing is, I was sort of right to a point. And this is where the film gets into the territory that is probably really Where I think on one hand, again, to come back to the idea that the misidentification of the film being a retread, on one hand, I think this is kind of a clever way to suddenly switch everybody's expectations here by dropping this reveal, which is that it turns out that, yes, Annie is related to her ancestors committed this crime, but her entire family is also descended from the child that Robitaille had with the plantation owner's daughter there. Caroline, if I remember correctly, is the character's name. And, oh man,
as a twist, though, there's a lot of really interesting potential. And I think, like, this film strikes me on this front as a big what could have been, because I think the problem is that all of a sudden by being like, okay, well, you're not only connected to the monster, but that complicates everything we've seen previously regarding Annie and sort of her interaction with marginalized communities and the idea of like self-disavowal and self-denial and sort of, you know, Candyman as is sort of the consequences of burying the past or refusing to acknowledge it. Whereas, like, all of a sudden that takes a much deeper resonance when we realize, oh, well, she is also the child, like, the descendant of the monster, and yes, her family purposely tried to bury that link and write him out of history. But the issue is, by the time it happens, the twist is great, it's shocking, and you do not see it coming. I think it's delivered really effectively. But then it has to follow sort of the yardsticks that are set out by the rest of the narrative before and after that. And it funnels it into a way that it doesn't explore it fruitfully. And instead, it gets funneled into probably its most problematic distillation. Because after that, I mean, it plays out like your standard last 15 minutes of a horror film. We understand Daniel, we sympathize with him, we recognize the problematics at play, and then Annie just finds his magic weakness and destroys him, so she effectively gets to bury him all over again. Except this time, like, we have the added knowledge of how deeply unfair this is.
Well, this is the thing that's really, there's so many things to unpack here, because you're absolutely hitting the nail on the head, because first of all, to explain that, you know, his magic weakness thing, in making the Candyman as Condon puts, a more literal figure, they end up adding, like I said, they add to the mythos or at least explicitly make clear in the mythos that, yes, he was a real person, that, yes, this is his actual spirit. But they also add that part and parcel of how he's in this position is because his lover's mirror was there at the moment of his death and was used to derisively mock him after being stung nearly to death. And somehow, in part, this somehow becomes his tether to the world even after he's dead. So yeah, it's a mess.
Because I don't think, though, Dave, that we've actually explained, like, the gimmick for Candyman, other than bees and a hook for a hand.
Yes.
Which, I mean, are suitable gimmicks in and of themselves. But yeah, his big thing, it's the Bloody Mary story, where if you say the word Candyman 5 times while looking into a mirror, that's what summons him into our world. But we discover he's able to go through mirrors because there's one special mirror that he has a link to.
Yeah, and that's the thing, because, you know, it's one of those things that was established in the first film, but it's thematically probably the most peculiar element of it. I mean, I think there are ways you can sort of squint and see how it connects, but it's not, you know, it feels like it added extra urban legend touch in that first movie, just to sort of heighten that connection with the idea of Candyman as a figure of sort of folklore type element. Whereas here, yeah, suddenly it becomes a literal, no, you must smash the magic object and he will turn into a bad CGI effect and die, which is exactly what happens. So you have on that level, that's problematic in and of itself. But I think there's two other things that become really deeply troubling here, which is the fact that, as you keep referring to him, Andrew, you know, you call the Candyman the monster in this instance. And the thing about it is, once you get the revelation of his history, it's hard. I mean, to me, it's one of those things where you can't really just call him And this is not criticism of you, I'm saying, I'm just saying, talking about in general, it's, you can no longer dismiss him as just the monster at this point.
From the twist onward, well, okay, it's not just that they're related, but through that whole twist and up to and inclusive of the flashback of Daniel's origins and sort of from his perspective and like fully taking in everything that his death consisted of. Like, the problem is, it's that, yeah, you're right. He's not the monster anymore. He becomes something else. But the narrative still treats him like a monster.
Well, no, you're absolutely, that's exactly it. I mean, he, you know, what could have been a case of either an anti-hero or the idea where this film approaches the notion of maybe finding some form of resolution. Or the ability to reconcile with the past in a meaningful way. You know,
well, yeah, because that's in the climactic scene where him and Annie are both staring into the mirror. And, you know, at this point, we also find out that Annie is pregnant. So Daniel's plan, presumably, is to sacrifice her, as the subtitle says, a farewell to the flesh, and that they're basically going to be reunited beyond death somewhere and finally, like, restore that family link. But what he keeps imploring her to do is look, and specifically he says that he needs her to bear witness.
Yes.
And I think that's such an important idea, and that's such, like, an interesting statement of desire. Because we realize, like, Daniel doesn't just want to go and punish everybody who has ever wronged him in that. It's, we understand, like, there's something very tragic in that declaration. Because he is monsterized because he has been written out of history, and the only thing he craves to find peace is for somebody to recognize him and somebody to actually, like, look at what he has experienced. And, like, I know we keep saying that, like, critical race theory and sort of, you know, the Black tradition of arts, that isn't something we're totally equipped to talk about in a meaningful way, but I think there's something very, very powerful and for 1995 very culturally resonant about that kind of statement.
Well, no, absolutely, and I think this is where the film at its best, you know, even though it botches the landing by far, is at least, it's making a really strong effort to try and grapple with these issues and have the audience grapple with these issues. But ultimately, yeah, because it ends up going back into the convention of, well, now we need to have the big confrontation and he must be defeated. Suddenly, yeah, it sort of writes those complications off in a way that is utterly unsatisfying. But,
well, yeah, because Annie's justification, she's sort of thinking about it, and then she flashes back to her dead family members and then decides, no, you're not going to bring pain to anybody else. So in that moment, though, it completely sweeps everything we've learned about Daniel under the rug, because it all gets relegated to, okay, well, you have this interesting story and, like, this really productive potential to explore, like, in ideological or social terms. And instead it becomes, yeah, well, you also killed people that I like, so off with you then.
Yeah, and I mean, it's double, I mean, and this is where it gets even more complicated and more problematic as well, because, number one, what we haven't acknowledged is that this whole sequence of events is taking place in the former slave quarters on the plantation that Annie's family owns, or at least did own, which is like, and that's the thing, because part and parcel of what the trouble is, there's no reckoning in terms or with the notion of, yeah, your family is wealthy, built off, you know, the backs of slavery. And
yeah, and there's a really telling moment, though, when Annie discovers in the records that the slave quarters beneath her manor home was Daniel's birthplace and becomes the site of the confrontation. Because she's looking in the records and she recognizes the name of the estate. And her response is not, oh my god, my family owns slaves. It's, oh my god, that's my family's house.
Yeah, and that is, you know, so unsatisfying and troubling. Because it then becomes the notion of, you know, and I find this interesting because Condon acknowledges on the commentary track that, you know, there was controversy surrounding this film when it came out because the poster had an image of Rowan's face with Tony set up against Tony Todd's body with his hook hand resting up above, and you know how this happens in the midst of the OJ trial, and this idea of a black man, quote unquote, threatening a white woman. And to me, I look at this film and realize, yeah, no, what's really troubling here is the power dynamics of the wealthy white woman who can't even acknowledge the fact that, yeah, my family's committed atrocities and this dude has legitimate reasons to kind of come after us if he's choosing to do so.
Well, but like, that's the other issue though, because I mean, we've talked about, We've had protagonists before that are very ignorant or sort of uncritical about their own status as a white person.
Yeah.
Like White Dog is a good example of that here, or the first Candyman, you know, does it so much better here. Because, like, I don't think this film also positions Annie as a sympathetic character basically all throughout. But when you break it down, though, Her motivation is kind of, look, Candyman, all these bad things happen to you as a result of racism and as a result of slavery, but that's in the past and it has nothing to do with me, which is the exact same argument that most conservatives will make when you talk about things like affirmative action or reparations. And it's just, the problem is by having her be the uncritical hero, I feel this film is accidentally valorizing that mindset.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I don't think that this is a case of Condor them intending to make that kind of a argument. It's just, yeah, it's the unintended consequence of the way in which this film is structured.
Yeah, it's like the second Avengers movie. Like, I don't for a second believe that Joss Whedon meant to say that women who can't have children are monsters just like Bruce Banner. But at the end of the day, regardless of intent, that's what's happening on screen, and it's really, you can't set that aside.
No, absolutely. And I think what complicates this further, and this is something where I honestly, it feels timely, given the some of the events of the weekend which we're recording this to just talk about. But we also have to get into the fact that, yeah, when the film establishes that there is a link between Annie's family and Daniel, and that his daughter was, you know, Annie's great-great-grandmother, there then, I think it's hard to put aside the question of the casting of the Truant family throughout this film, whether it's Kelly Rowan, William O'Leary, or even Veronica Cartwright, because I could be wrong. Maybe they're, you know, please correct me if I'm incorrect in this. I believe they all are white actors, who are not biracial or whose ancestry I believe traces back to predominantly European.
You're very nice,
dude. I'm trying to find the delicate way to put it, but the point of the matter is
they scan as white.
Yes.
There is no mistaking them as white middle class family. To which I would say, well, the Candyman looks like he's full of bees, but this family is full of wasps.
Ba-dum-dum. God.
Thank you for bearing with me.
Yes.
But yeah, like, and I mean, that's kind of forgivable because they do mention that Daniel's daughter was raised as a white child. Now, but it brings that up, like, accusatorily. And so I think there would be interesting space there to deal with the idea of, like literally, like, giving somebody a different cultural identity sort of against their will. And I feel like this film could sidestep the issue of sort of disparate casting if it made more of an issue of that, or, like, really delved into that and explored the idea of, like, you know, have we been transformed from our history and from our cultural identity? But yeah, as is, though, it's just, oh, well, across three generations, somehow you go from looking like Tony Todd to being Kelly Rowan.
Well, and this is the thing. Like, I mean, like, I think it's one of those cases where I almost feel, and again, first of all, like, putting it, this is a film that comes out in 1995. And certainly looking at it from the 2018 lens, particularly as these have been issues that are finally, I would say, at least getting addressed in public discourse, if not necessarily being matched in what's actually happening in Hollywood casting of films. It's the casting choices here are not unexpected from from what this film is and when it came out. It just feels it suddenly adds a new dimension of, well, if you have a character whose ancestry is tied to having black ancestry, it feels really uncomfortable not having the casting in some form reflect that.
Well, is it any worse than Emma Stone playing a Hawaiian, you know?
Well,
this is a problem that's endemic to Hollywood and has been since Hollywood even was a thing. Just the issue is, like, this film gives itself almost like that escape hatch where it can almost get away with it if it committed more fully to exploring, like, the optics of race, I suppose, through its narrative. It just, it sets that up but doesn't do it. And as a result, all we see is, we end up getting indications of this film's, like, loadedness. But then by playing out conventionally, once again, like, it squanders the idea. And if it develops some of those ideas a little bit further, you know, not to say that it would be the same or as good as the first Candyman film, but I think it would be a more distinct film and certainly a more interesting one. Or at least one that doesn't make us slap our foreheads at the same time and say, they really did that, didn't they?
Well, yeah, but it's just, I'm thinking about this because, again, there was a film, I want to say it's from the early 2000s, and I'm blanking on the title, where they did things where, you know, it's Anthony Hopkins cast as a character.
The Human Stain.
That's the one, yes. Who's
the film itself is a stain upon the screen.
But, I mean, it's the thing, it's like where he's a, you know, a white actor cast to play a character who's supposed to be, you know, erasing his black ancestry. And it's like, Anthony Hopkins was your first choice for that.
Yeah, it's like, it's one thing to, because again, like, even with Daniel's child, I think they specify, like, she was very fair-skinned, being a biracial child. But when they say that about Anthony Hopkins, who, like, was born looking like he rolled around in dust for an hour, you know, it rings very hollow.
Yeah, it's one of these cases where I don't know whether we can divorce this film from that overall context of Hollywood's history. I mean, in terms of, it feels to me, I don't think I can give it a pass on that level, necessarily. And again, it's one of these things where, of course, once again, we are talking about a 1995 sequel out of a Hollywood studio PolyGram to a surprise hit from 3 years earlier.
Yeah, it's, like, this is not a film that encourages expectations from the outset, but I would say that it makes enough intelligent moves that in watching it, it gets your hopes up.
Well, and that's just it.
Somehow to me, that's worse.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I mean, you can't tell, I mean, you know, and I would be willing to bet if somebody brought this, I don't know if anybody's ever discussed this with Condon or not, but I would be very curious to get his perspective on this, because I, particularly again after listening to his commentary, I get the feeling he would probably mostly not in agreement and recognize that this is something that in hindsight he would not necessarily have done, or at least they would have tried to finesse it more in terms of how they grapple with the issue on screen. And it's one of these things where, I mean, in terms of the actual actors they've cast to play the family, I mean, Veronica Cartwright is, you know, Veronica Cartwright, you know, she's a legend for a reason.
Classic old money, histrionic, slightly drunk mother.
Yeah.
You know, it feels though, like, that's one of those areas where, as I said before we recorded, like, the frustrating thing is that this is half of a really interesting movie. The problem is, it's not that it just falls apart after a certain point. It's that even in the scenes that are good, like, there are just certain elements that become obstacles. And, like, Veronica Cartwright, I think she gives a great performance from a different movie, especially that confrontation right before her death, where Annie, having learned the truth about her ancestry, confronts her mother. And it basically turns into Bad Tennessee Williams. And, like, Cartwright is very talented. She's playing her part well. It's just they wrote the character wrong. In the sense that she's that kind of archetypal figure that I feel Candyman as a figure really, throughout the first one, and even through most of this film, sort of resists being buttonholed so easily. So all of a sudden you're confronted with, like, these very stock characters, and something just doesn't gel.
You're not wrong, and I think, I mean, certainly when it comes to the Cartwright character, they give all sorts of unnecessary extra details that don't really factor into this film for her. Like, the fact that she's apparently dying of cancer. Well, okay, does that actually register in any meaningful way in this movie? Because, A, guess what? She doesn't die from cancer in the course of this film. She gets a hook right through her stomach, which...
Maybe it's a metaphor.
Maybe it is. Also, I was going to say, arguably better or worse. You decide, listener.
Send your postcards to David.
Yeah. But yeah, and I think part of it is that there are some odd tonal elements to this film where because it feels less because of Condon as a director and more just him trying to navigate the balance between the conventional side of film and trying to honor what hit the film that preceded it. You get these weird moments where you've got certain actors who are playing it for real and really, you know, trying to do something. It's like Tony Todd, who, again, we haven't really touched on him as an actor yet in this case. And Todd is amazing in both
these
movies.
He is fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, I think part of the reason why they've sort of limited how many Candymen they made is that, having seen Tony Todd in the role, I cannot imagine any other actor who would be as effective in it.
Well, no, I mean, he brings, like, this guy has got a Shakespearean-level chops to him. And he doesn't play this like he's slumming it in a, you know, cheap movie. No, he is going full bore into the pathos and tragedy behind this character. And the way in which he uses his voice, because he doesn't, again, credit to both these movies, they don't overplay their hand by showing you too much of the figure of the Candyman.
And so this one gets perilously close, but yeah, like, he shares equal screen time with everybody else. Like, he remains the figure at the margins, but whenever he pops up, it's effective.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of the monologues he gets throughout this, particularly in that final confrontation where he describes, you know, what he went through. And then watching his performance of him having to live through this incident. Like, Todd will break your heart in this movie. And he unquestionably is fantastic. Then you get Kelly Rowan. And Rowan's not a bad actor, but she feels a little in over her head at points, where at least, you know, she doesn't know how to navigate the tone quite as well.
I feel like her agent sold her on this film being like, oh, it'll be the next Nightmare on Elm Street franchise. And like, she went into it thinking that's what she was making, and then they gave her the script being like, oh, okay, well, now grapple with racial trauma.
Well, yeah, and you get these weird moments. Like, there's this scene where she talks to her brother in the police interrogation room of the police station. And she has, like, this confrontation where she starts yelling at him. And the way in which she starts yelling at people in this film, like, she doesn't have... Like, you put her up against Veronica Cartwright or Tony Todd, and she just doesn't have the same... It doesn't feel like she can stand her ground with those two actors.
Yeah. Well, especially, I mean, Tony Todd, probably like the richest baritone in all of Hollywood. You know, the contrast makes you realize just how thin her voice is. Like, there's no presence to it.
Yeah.
So even when she gets worked up and like screams at her mother, it's like, you can't bury the past by hiding in a bottle. It comes off as just puffery.
It's like dangerously close.
It sounds so hollow.
Yeah. Well, it's dangerously close to made for TV at that point. Like, you feel like, okay, this is the, you know, the true crime story for those early Saturday night made for TV movies where, you know, here's some real life American tragedy and we filmed this in 2 weeks and here you go. This is what you get. And
yeah, Columbo was busy.
Yeah, and then you get, you know, other actors, you know, but then again, you get Bill Nunn as Reverend Ellis, who, again, much like Tony Todd, isn't on screen much, But man, does he make his scenes count.
He forms a very interesting counterpoint as a character, even though they don't develop him nearly as far enough. Like, Bill Nunn, as well, a wonderful baritone, and like Todd, there's that reservedness about him. Like, a sort of stoicism, because Nunn in this film is the local priest.
Yeah.
And, you know, who also doubles as sort of the local historian of, well, I guess, local history, including the slave era. And so he stands in as the figure that does remember, and the one that does want to look back, and may... But at the same time, it's complicated by, well, he's also, you know, as a priest, he stands in for certain traditions, some of which have been exposed as very problematic through time. But they represent different sides of belief, but their mannerisms are very similar. Because, like, yeah, I mean, going back to the idea of Candyman as a monster doesn't seem to fit, because he's not running full speed, chasing people down a hallway. He's not, like... terrorizing teenagers or anything like that. He's not screaming and frothing at the mouth or anything. He is always so calm and deliberate in his mannerisms that everyone else freaks out around him and he doesn't break a sweat. And that just, that's why Tony Todd is so effectively creepy in the role. Bill Nunn, though, is like, he's the counterpoint where he is most of those same qualities, just standing in for different forces. So I would honestly be much more interested in a film that follows the Reverend and him trying to deal with the local myth of the Candyman. Like, I feel like that would be so much more interesting than white girl discovers Link, white girl buries Link again.
Well, you're absolutely right. No, I would completely agree with you. It would make a nice switch from the first film, which, yeah, that's Virginia Madison's film, in terms of screen time and who has the narrative arc of that movie, and to suddenly switch it, okay, we've now seen this outsider peering into something, into a community in a history she doesn't understand, to somebody part of that community who knows that history. How do they grapple with it? How do they see the figure of the Candyman would be far more fascinating.
Well, yeah, because that would be a marked difference intellectually, even carrying through the same threads. Like, that is a marked difference from the first one. And instead, we get a different figuration of that same tension as the first. There's a different emphasis, and the story develops differently as we've gone over, but yeah, we're still experiencing people at a remove from the action.
Absolutely. And you know what the other thing would be if they had done that, Andrew? You know what that is?
What?
David Giannopoulos wouldn't be in the movie. And that would be so much better, because if we want to talk about the worst performer in this movie, and the one who seems to be in a completely different film from everybody else, Giannopoulos' Detective Levesque, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, is, oh man, where do you even begin?
The man has never met scenery that he couldn't chew. But yeah, he, like... I know I said about Cartwright, but, like, he is so unaware of what movie he's in, because he stands out with everything he does. He is a pure archetype. He's the hard-ass cop.
Yeah. I mean,
and that's all he is.
Yeah. He's the hard-case cop who is, you know, I'm bound to go and get my man. I am going to get them. And...
yelling solves problems.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm willing to bend rules. Do you think I'm not going to spy on somebody in an office even though they're supposed to have privacy? You know, I'm not going to let them walk away from this. I mean, he is awful. And then you get to, and he has nothing to do in this movie, because his plot line ultimately goes nowhere.
I was going to say, he's like the worst screen detective in a horror movie since Danny Glover in the original Saw. Because, yeah, like, they could have cut his character from the film entirely, kept the rest of the plot as is. Nothing would have changed.
No, absolutely. And his death scene is... it's satisfying, but not for the reasons I think that was intended. Like, it's not like, oh man, that's a great gore gag. It's more of the fact that, oh, they finally removed this obnoxious, annoying character from my presence.
Yay, now the rest of the film...
yeah, and I mean,
start.
Just the way in which he's... his interrogation with William O'Leary, who... by the way, William O'Leary... I will say this. I hope to God he was cast in an episode of Law and Order at some point as the initial suspect, because that's the level of performance he gives in this film. And that's perfect. It's just not good enough for this movie.
He did play Tim the Toolman Taylor's younger brother on Home Improvement.
That's where I recognize him from. Oh my God.
But like, this is also a guy with Broadway credits, which is so odd because he seems to do that thing that nervous or incapable actors do, where in order to emote, they sort of scrunch their face, but then just yell like they're whining. And that's supposed to be, like, his emotional breaking point. But, like, the whole scene, the interrogation scene that culminates in both men's death, that's one of those movie-breaking moments. Because right before I started watching this film, David actually texted me and said, I'm very curious to hear what you think of two performances. And I'm like, all right, I wonder what they're going to be. And then this scene happened, and I'm like, well, I know what performances he meant. Because, yeah, it basically... It cuts to them in the interrogation room, and the detective is already yelling because he's basically like, oh, we realize your sister's the one doing all of it. You're covering for her. Tell us the truth. And then the brother just does his, like, whine yell of, no, it's not what you think.
Yeah, it is.
And then Candyman shows up and...
but not before we get to hear Giannopoulos do the most annoying version of the five Candyman.
Candyman!
It's like, oh my... It's awful. Awful, awful. Although this is probably a good point, time to point out that, as Bill Condon notes on the commentary track, the police station in this film is the library from Seven. So, yeah.
Really?
So keep that in mind if you ever want to do double bills based on shooting locations. But yeah, it's... Oh, man, it is... Awful. But I mean, but then again, you go from stuff like that and you get someone like Matt Clark, who shows up as the sort of local Candyman expert, or at least the one that Annie's father met.
Well, he's kind of like a fence, right? It's sort of implied that like objects that want to be bought and sold outside of official channels, they find their way.
Yeah. And I love the fact that he's got this, you know, den in his snow cone shack where he's got all this stuff located. And I give Clark credit for giving the perfect character actor in a horror movie performance, where he is just, it's that kind of hamming it up that feels appropriate rather than out of place.
As opposed to, say, Annie's husband in the film. But yeah, like, going back to Cartwright, it feels like, oh, well, we're going to give her a drinking problem, and we're going to give her cancer. This will help make her real. And it's like, you don't need to do that. Thibodeau, all we see about him is that he works a snow cone truck, and he's really charming, and that's enough to make him feel like a full-bodied character in ways that the others aren't.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, even just his weird flirtations with the woman in... I'm assuming it's supposed to be... Is it Cleopatra, you know, cosplay, or...
I think so. She's all dressed up for Mars.
Yeah, and it's just like they have this weird flirtatious relationship that Annie sort of bursts in on in her quest for more information about her situation. And yeah, it's just, yeah, he just comes in. He's in the movie for like maybe 6 minutes, but...
And three of them, he is being stung by bees.
Yes, true. And then has his head thrown through the aluminum siding of his shack, which is, not necessarily a dignified death, but Clark makes do.
Yeah, he makes the most of his 10 minutes. We'll give him that. He's the Gina Rowlands of Candyman 2. But yeah, like, and again, he's just a likable, affable character. And I feel like this film could have been so much better if they cut the detective and the brother and, like, populated it with characters like Thibodeau. Because they don't spell out their whole life story. They don't become, like, anchor points in the narrative. But, like, it almost corresponds more to, like, the heroic journey cycle, where we have Annie just going, and she meets Bill Nunn, and she meets Thibodeau, and just meets all these people. And that might give the narrative more of, like, that sort of dreamlike quality of the first one, as opposed to, like, sort of the on-rails, everything-is-grounded narrative.
Well, I think what adds to the problems is also the nature of the setup is basically means that Annie is a resident of New Orleans. She's been around. Her family's been around. They're known in the community. Spo, it kind of strikes you as weird when you consider that everybody in this town, including our Kingfisher, the nonstop DJ, who sounds like Remy LeBeau from the X-Men, went on a bender and decided just to start yelling out stuff on the radio. She is, like, how is she oblivious? Because everybody seems to know everything about Candyman. It's well known enough to get talked about on, yeah, daytime and nighttime radio.
Yeah, and I think that's, like, in the first one, it's not a problem because the idea of the Candyman mythos is linked very specifically to the Cabrini yes. Green Housing Project. So this very specific site within a marginalized sphere within another marginalized sphere. Whereas here, yeah, like, everybody knows who Candyman is except her, and she's still unaware after her father ends up dead going looking for him.
But even her students know enough. Like, I mean, are they only just now talking about this legendary figure in her classroom? Which just seems odd, particularly given how, as we go on to throughout the rest of the film, she has a boundary-pushingly unclose relationship with her students. When they can hunt you down at your mother's place and be invited in to talk about, you know, the one student who went missing, who also happens to be the Reverend's son, we might add.
And also happens to show up right at the climax so he can rescue the white lady from Candyman.
And who also happens to be having visions of the Candyman and decides that the most logical thing to do is to just go hide at the old family house where somehow he knows Candyman some connected to. Like, I don't know. Like, it doesn't really, That stuff just makes no sense, and it feels very uncomfortably like, I'm trying to think about what the best analogy I could come up with.
It's like if there's Dangerous Minds, and then there's Freedom Riders for people who think Dangerous Minds is just too cerebral. This would be, like, the next step.
Yeah, it is just so, so, it feels clunky.
Well, because that's an element of the film where there's a clear power differential, and even though it's not like the teacher-student relationship, that's not an inherently racial disparity. But in the way that it's characterized in this film, I mean, you have a white teacher and poor black students, and basically the function of that is that all the students are there to effectively, like, serve and perform a function for Annie. And the film does this uncritically. So it gives us a very distinct white messiah sensibility at various points, especially when it's like, well, Annie is going to go looking for this kid because implicitly nobody else cares enough to. I'll be that one person who makes a difference. And I just have
to. Well, that's exactly it. Which leads to the first scene in which Bill Nunn appears as his character. She goes to find him to ask about whether she can help, and she's getting told off by two local residents there. And it's the only time we ever get the indication that, yeah, Annie's kind of inserting herself into places where it may not be wise to do so. But then Bill Nunn comes out, and it's like, oh no, she's fine, come on in, come on in.
Well, it kind of, okay, I think I may have said before, but Crash, Paul Haggis' film, is one of those movies that I think is, in its own odd, clumsy way, ends up being a far more racist film than it tries to be in trying to present a narrative about overcoming racial boundaries. But there's one scene that I always, that has stuck with me, and is when Ryan Philippe, the police officer, intervenes and, like, talks the cops down from shooting Terrence Howard, and, like, they have the standoff. And Philippe tells him, look, you need to realize I'm trying to help you. And Terrence Howard just looks at him and says, I didn't ask for your help. And, like, moments like that are interesting because it pushes back against the idea of the benevolent white person in a position of authority, you know, that it's their job to take on themselves to, like, to go around being kind enough to assist those who need it. Because, I mean, like, that's not to say don't be charitable or don't look out for your neighbor, but, like, in a film that is, shall we say, bracketed in the way that this film is, it comes off very differently than it was probably intended to.
Well, and it doesn't help, again, that the opulence of Annie's lifestyle is very much foregrounded, because we haven't even mentioned the fact that, yeah, her and her husband, I mean, putting aside the fact that she comes from a wealthy family that attracts media attention even when she just shows up at, you know, at the police station, he seems to run a successful business as a chef in New Orleans. And not from the looks of it, it's a pretty successful business. They seem to have a very opulent home/apartment, as it were, enough so that, you know, he can, you know, sleep in very fine pajamas, as it were.
Plus, it's also nice to know that, you know, with the culturally distinct and hugely important Louisiana Creole cooking scene, that white people can do it just as well as everyone else.
And let's not forget he has a cell phone, because I swear, I was convinced when they started foregrounding that the fact that he has a cell phone, and Annie's immediate question is, why do you have that? I figured, okay, it's 1995. They're probably mentioning that because it's going to play into some other later part of the movie. It's some important role. Nope. Never comes up again.
No, they just dropped that in because it's like, see, now everyone in the back seats will know that these people are millionaires.
It's such an awkward scene.
Look at how small it is. It probably only weighs 13 pounds.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Talk about grappling with the historical past. Yeah, it's just, like, this is a film, and again, like, I think this film means well, but honestly, the fact that for every element that's fascinating that it introduces, especially with regards to race and power and class divisions, because it stumbles just as often as it introduces something productive, that really kind of makes me think that it only wanders into this territory accidentally. Yeah, it really feels like both in good ways and bad ways, there's something just sort of accidental about the real juicy elements of this film.
I will give them maybe a bit more benefit of the doubt, particularly because of how forthright Condon's been about how the film's flawed, to at least say that, yeah, I think that they were aiming high. It's just a case that, whether it's the nature of the way in which the project was developed and what the expectations of it were as a horror sequel, and Condon's relative lack of power, and the fact that he came into the process relatively late in the game. Again, he wasn't there at the gestation of this thing. He was pretty much hired, from the sounds of it, pretty close to the date of shooting, or when shooting was supposed to begin on this film. You know, it's probably just a case of he was making the best with what he had, and everybody was. It's just, yeah, the industrial structures at play wouldn't let it go any further.
Well, exactly. If you're trying to build a franchise that actually makes money and more than just critics and scholars are super jazzed about, like, you can't make Bernard Rose's Candyman over and over and turn that into a money-making franchise. It just simply can't happen. So this film ends up being this weird hybridization of some of the ideas introduced in the first one and some of the stylistic flourishes, but ultimately it's sort of all overridden by the idea of, well, let's cash in, let's make some money, and let's suddenly build a new horror villain for what's left of the 1990s.
Yeah. But hey, at least we got Gods and Monsters out of it 3 years later.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, this film is baffling in some respects, and it has something in common with the first film, which is where it kind of looks cheap from the outside, and it kind of looks like it's going to be dumb and superficial or just odd, and it ends up sort of outperforming those expectations. I think on the whole, like, you're right, it can't be the first film, and it's nowhere near as good or even the same kind of film as Candyman was. And just the moments where you can see it's not purely being steered by studio executives, there are interesting spaces opened up, and there are interesting ideas at play. It's just, This is a film that starts the conversation. It does not have that conversation with you.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's a film worth watching, particularly if you enjoyed the first film. You know, this movie isn't going to ruin that film for you, and it's not like it is a sacrilegious, you know, desecration of everything the first film was. It's just, it tries to honor that first film and stumbles quite severely along the way. But it's hard not to come away from it without appreciating the effort that went into it. And as I'm sure we'll get into in the hits and pits segment in a moment, you know, there are quite a few things that even that we haven't said, as superficial as they may be, that are, you know, well worth at least watching the film to witness.
Yeah. And it's 90 minutes. It moves at a brisk clip. Even the bad elements are so bad that they're worth watching. So, I mean, especially with Halloween coming, you could probably find worse horror films to fill out a marathon or just even watch by yourself at 3 o'clock in the morning than Candyman Farewell to the Flesh.
I'm now trying to think, because will this episode drop before Halloween or after? Before. It should be out by the 29th.
Every day is Halloween if you live with depression.
Wow.
So I guess before we say farewell to this flesh, I think we should probably steer to our patent-pended bumper segment.
Yep.
Hits and Pits, where we, as Dave alluded to, we look at the smaller moments worth celebrating and condemning in equal measure. So, Dave, you picked this one, so I'm going to give you the first hit.
I really want to highlight the cinematography of Tobias S. Schleissler. Schleissler, yeah. We apologize to you no matter what. But, you know, even though I know the word cheap around this film has come up a couple times, I gotta say, it's a good-looking horror film from the 90s. I mean, it has a kind of warmth and vibrancy in terms of the visual image that you don't typically see. I would say certainly in most contemporary digitally shot horror films. And I kind of miss that look that this film has, where it's not quite Tales from the Crypt, but it's more heightened than you would see in an otherwise realistic grounded drama.
Yeah, the color and lighting I feel are pretty expressionistic, like especially the scenes in the church, or pretty much any time that the Candyman appears on screen, there's usually quite a lot of light filtering, you know, strobe effects, and those rapid cuts to either, you know, his portrait on the wall or, you know, the indignities that he suffered in his life. Like, it's visually distinct and it is disorienting, much as the figure of Candyman appearing before you probably is.
No, absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, I would really recommend, if you have access to being able to watch the HD version of the film, it's worth popping it into, putting out the cash for that version, just to see some of the really great visuals and shots that crop in throughout this. But what about you, Andrew? What would you say is your first pick for this one?
Well, we already talked about Thibodeau's snow cone truck, so I think I'm going to double down, though, and really just highlight Tony Todd. Like, this isn't just a case where, like, it seems like a great performance because it's a bad movie or because he's the only competent person there. It's a shame that, because I almost feel Tony Todd was so good in this role that he kind of got typecast in horror type pictures for the rest of his career. But there is an energy to his role, considering he is so static. Like, every time he shows up, he's like a force of nature here. And you believe him as this incomprehensible threat up until the moment that he grounds himself and reveals who he is and that his weakness is a magic mirror. But like, he's just so good here. I know that's not in depth and it's not a full evaluation or anything, but like, it's probably been about 5 or 6 years since I've seen Bernard Rose's Candyman, and I've never seen this one previously. It was so nice to just see him on screen because, yeah, for all you can say about this film as a whole, anytime he's called upon to do something, he does it flawlessly.
Well, he brings dignity to this movie, and I think that's really the strong point. Like, you can look at the performance he gives this movie, and you can see that he is giving it his 100% throughout it. There's the, you just get the feeling, it's like, yeah, I don't care even if this is a slasher film. I'm going to give this the same level of respect and effort that I would give to, you know, if I was giving, some, I don't know, a film directed by Peter Weir.
Yeah.
I have no idea whether they've worked together.
It's not a case of, like, skewed expectations given the fact that it's a genre not known for great performances. Like, put him in any film, and he is a talented actor, and there would be no franchise without him, and deservedly so, because he's amazing.
Absolutely. So, speaking of things that are amazing, we never really did talk about Philip Glass.
My next hit.
Oh, sorry. But yeah, no, I mean, the thing about Philip Glass is, I mean, from what we end up finding out from Condon, the majority of the score to this film is the score from the preceding Candyman, with the major exception being that he did write new music specifically for the character of Annie throughout the film, as or Annie's theme, as Condon refers to it throughout it. And the thing is, that's fine that the majority of the score is the same one from the first one, because it is such a weird, unique, eerie thing. It doesn't sound quite like anything else that you will see hear in a horror film.
Yeah, like it's somewhere between Hans Zimmer and Tangerine Dream. Like, it's, like, Glass, at least in this film, like, there's this very odd and, like, difficult to parse out blend of organic and inorganic instruments. And, like, especially that end title theme, it's not even, like, lyrics. It's, like, operatic vocalizations. And it's over what could just as easily be, like, a church pipe organ or a Yamaha synthesizer. And, like, it is this weird mix of elements that shouldn't work together, but it ends up being like just very fluid and destabilizing on a sonic level. And in that context, like, it is the perfect score to set this story to.
No, absolutely. And I mean, yeah, it's again, the involvement of someone like Glass really does give this film a sort of, I don't want to say it gives it greater legitimacy, because I think that's, you know, false. But, I mean, Glass is somebody who's not known for having a wide body of work in film. I mean, he's certainly done movies, but he's not a composer who makes his living doing film, nothing but film scores. This is something he does selectively. And yeah, I mean, you can really see when you listen to this score, I mean, you know, he gives it that extra layer that it might otherwise be missing if they were to go with something more conventional as a horror score from one of the maybe the old standards out there, which I'm not going to name names because I like their work as well, but yeah, you're not Philip Glass in terms of uniqueness. So, but what about you, Andrew? Now that I've stolen your second hit, what would you like to offer as your replacement for that?
You know, okay, I have something that is going to equally be a hit in the pit. So maybe it's okay. Apropos this is our last one. The final jump scare.
Okay.
It's a very effective jump scare, I will give it that. Because at the end, Annie smashes the mirror and the Candyman literally breaks apart. It then goes to sometime in the future. And we see Annie going through the photo album of the family with her daughter, who is now born and named Caroline, after Daniel's long-dead lover. And, you know, it ends with her putting her daughter down for a nap, and then it hangs for much longer than you would expect it to. Just like the camera panning around the room, and you know something's going to happen, but it draws out that weight, and that tension makes it, it builds really, really well. And then finally the girl looks at the little mirror sort of spinner hung over the crib, and she starts saying Candyman. And then midway through the fifth one, Annie bursts her head out from the left of the frame and basically just yells at her daughter, "I told you to nap!" And there's the perfect musical stinger too. And yes, even when you know it's coming, because it draws out that tension, it's very effective. It's probably the only jump scare I actually jumped at. But here's the problem, and why it becomes my first miss. This is effectively the last thing that happens in the movie. And it's a jump scare, but most jump scares by design are kind of like fake outs, right? So we realize that, nope, the Candyman's not there. It's just Annie. And so the final shot of the film is, after silencing her daughter and telling her to nap, it's just Annie looking down into a crib for about 5 seconds before then it cuts and the credits roll. And I'm like, that is so anticlimactic. It doesn't end on a cliffhanger. It ends with us being tricked, and then we see 5 seconds of awkward silence.
I'll push back a little bit on that, because I really do like that closing shot and the way in which it does conclude myself.
Okay.
I love the sort of uncertainty of it, because this idea of, oh, Annie, you know, it's like, well, she's defeated the Candyman, everything's gone to normal, or quote-unquote back to normal, but she's not 100% certain. She's not willing to chance that, you know, maybe things aren't as resolved as she says she would. I also like the fact that when she's showing her talking to her daughter before she puts her down for a nap, they're talking about the idea of, you know, who are the members of your family.
Yeah, her great-great-grandfather Daniel and his pictures in the album, which is a nice touch, yeah. But it's kind of undercut by the fact that, well, 3 minutes prior, you also just decided to kill him.
True. You're not wrong about that. I like at least the effort to try and make something right of this, even if it isn't.
It kind of wants to have it both ways, but it is a nice touch. And, I mean, that further creates that false sense of, like, the resolution, at least before we get that long, long lingering shot that tells us something definitely bad is going to happen.
Yes. But now that we're into the pits proper, I guess I should probably acknowledge one that we've mentioned, but I really need to stress how bad this is.
Okay.
Russell Buchanan as Kingfisher. Oh, man, this narration is... Condon refers to it as himself as Two Wolfman Jack. And
this guy wishes he was Wolfman Jack.
Yeah, like this guy, I mean, like I said it before, but I'll say it again. You know, it's Gambit from the X-Men if he just decided to become a DJ or, you know, just start talking in that sort of faux Cajun accent of his and just start rambling on about things at random. And like, I'm trying to, as we're listening to his narration, I mean, it doesn't work because, number one, it's heavy-handed and unnecessary. We don't need it whatsoever. But it's also a matter of, what station does this guy work for? Like, what is his program? I don't know. All he seems to do is go on about Mardi Gras, eating fish,
and the Candyman.
It's like, this seems to be a very narrow... Like, who are you talking to?
Hey, everybody, Kingfish with your drive time commute. We got traffic backed up on the I-95 and Candyman coming at you with the weather. Like, yeah. It makes no sense.
Yeah, like, it's just absolutely ridiculous. And the thing about it that makes me even wonder is there's a shot when Annie... when she's on the run after Candyman has killed her mother, and she ends up in the Mardi Gras crowd as they're partying, there's a moment where she's looking up as this narration is going on, and there's a split-second shot you see of what I think may have intended to be the Kingfisher on screen, and it's this, you know, rather, much like myself, rotund gentleman in what looks like toga robes, and... But the voice sync doesn't quite match up right, so I can't tell whether that was supposed to be him and they dubbed it, or because it sounds like he's in amongst Mardi Gras from the way he's talking. Like, it's just very unclear and weird, and...
Yeah, and, like, it never is connected with the film, and it's never explained why this guy seems to... He literally is, like, the omniscient narrator of the film, but it's never rooted in anything that approaches an explanation. He's not a character that's encountered. It's not that he's, like, the voice of the community. It's, like, it's just there. But it's there so often in the film that it's impossible to get to the end of it and come away thinking beyond, like, well, that was purposeless.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just, it's one of those things where, and again, credit to Condon, he admits this was a mistake. But it's still in the movie, and it still kind of needs to be pointed out that, yeah, much like Giannopoulos, it's really grating really quickly. But I guess it's also part and parcel of that long, proud tradition of really obnoxious radio DJs in films. There's, like, maybe, like, a master list of, like, one that's tolerable. And I think that's Sam Jackson in Do the Right Thing.
I was going to say, Christian Slater in Pump Up the Volume. Well, but yeah, I feel like they're almost trying to get... the same effect as the radio narration in Do the Right Thing, but they're doing it just so much worse.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's definitely, I mean, yeah, Sam Jackson gets to play a character in that film.
So does Bill Nunn.
Yeah, the same cannot be said for the King Fisher here. But Andrew, I think I've made my general dislike for this character and the narration itself well known to our listeners. What is your second pit?
My second pit. I would say, like, I feel like the problem is this is also a film that, by the time this film begins, like, the rules of the Candyman aren't really well established, and that's fine. But, like, horror movies generally have, like, an explicit or implicit series of rules, right? Like, Freddy Krueger can only hurt you when you're dreaming. That's why everyone hated the second one, because it breaks those rules. You know, Jason only goes after the teenagers that kind of deserve it, for the most part. You know, it's... But this is a film where it's like, if everything revolves around the mirror, like, there are a number of times where, like, Candyman seems to just, like, wait and see, or, like, not necessarily extra... Like, he's not summoned forth, but he's allowed to pick when he shows up. Or, like, I'm pretty sure during Veronica Cartwright's death scene, Octavia, nobody calls him, does he? He just shows up. Like, because they're arguing, and she looks in the mirror, and then looks down and sees the hook, right? It's not like they're yelling at each other and accidentally say Candyman 5 times.
Well, no, but I think this ties back to the first film, where you only ever see Virginia Madison's character in that one say his name 5 times into a mirror once. And after that point, he's basically following her. So I think the films do operate on the logic that once he's been called by an individual, at least it seems to be whoever's within her sphere seems to be in equal amount of danger as she is. So I give it credit for that. What I find more questionable, if we're talking about rules that don't make any sense, is the degree to which the Candyman is understood as a physical entity, because part of the climax of this film involves the house getting swept up in water from the torrential downpour that's happening.
Yeah, because I originally thought that that was his death, because she grabs the mirror off the wall, and then the house floods, and we see the Candyman being washed away by the water, and I'm like, oh. But during the police sequence, we also see that, no, on camera, he's invisible. And he can travel through mirrors, because he has the one magic one, but water is also one of his weaknesses. Or at least it hurts him enough that it creates a buffer distance.
I guess. It's weird. It doesn't really stand up to logic. And yeah, I would almost say that would have improved the ending if it actually had been that the mirror... I mean, imagine if this film was Annie bears witness, the flood breaks thing, and then all of a sudden the mirror's accidentally destroyed.
Yeah, or like there's a sense of closure there or something. It's just, I guess the reason why sort of the arbitrariness of it bothers me is that the film goes out of its way to ground Daniel as a real person and give him this arbitrary, this arbitrary MacGuffin of the mirror, being like, this explains everything. It's the source of his power, and it's also why he can only travel through mirrors when summoned. And it's like, well, why make this a crucial plot point, and why develop that at all if you're just going to sort of disregard it on a scene-by-scene basis?
Yeah, that's
And I mean, I think that's more just indicative of the fact that this is a film that it does so many things well, but it has no sense of what to prioritize.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely fair.
Yes, any final pits from you?
Very, very quickly, Timothy Carhart, again... It's not that it's an awful performance. It just seems awkward in playing Annie's husband, Paul, because he's just, it's such a goofy character. And I get part of why they're doing it is because they want somebody who's memorable and likable enough that when he dies, you don't care. Plus, he's also not Xander Berkeley. So, I mean, that to me already automatically makes whoever it was a huge step up in the marriage department anyway. But yeah, his character just seems a tad bit too goofy in the early goings of the movie between his encounters with the homeless individuals who have taken up residence in Annie's old family plantation home, or his bit with, you know, making sure the car is locked when they start investigating it. Like, it's just like...
Yeah.
It's just a little overplayed, more than anything else. Well, also it begs
the question of, oh, so they have this lovely manor home, but they've also let it fall into disrepair, and now we're just, we're letting everybody use it as a squat, you know? But it's like in reclaiming that territory. Well, now you're stealing something from the community, so way to go, white people.
Yeah, although I am still trying to figure out the logic. So did Annie's father paint up the attic with all the Candyman paraphernalia?
Well, because they just allude to him being obsessed with the Candyman. And, yeah, so I guess that explains everything weird as just, yeah, this is just a function of the guy's obsession. I don't know, David. And I don't think anyone who made this film knows either.
That's fair. So, yeah, I guess this wraps up Candyman Farewell to the Flesh. It's reasonably easy to get your hands on, so you can go out and find a copy. But with that, Andrew, where are we going next, seeing as how I'm relinquishing the wheel?
Well, I think it's time to get out of the swamps of Louisiana and go, well, somewhere else. In this case, we are going to be following director Bill Condon 3 years later to a probably more celebrated film, Gods and Monsters, starring Ian McKellen and Brendan Fraser, looking at the life and death of famed horror director James Whale. So I honestly don't think I've actually seen this one, but I think it'll be a nice little through line. We get to talk about horror from a slightly different angle. And, you know, we're probably not going to have to drop nearly as many qualifiers over the next episode. So it'll be nice not to walk on eggshells.
That's true. So, but let's just say we accidentally broke some eggshells in the process. Andrew, where can people reach you?
You can find me on Twitter at FilmsTripper. And you, Dave?
Well, you can find me at Twitter as well, as at 24Panels. And what else, Andrew? Where can people say if they want to add commentary and review the show and point out how we added nuance and insight into this movie, or perhaps completely botched the job, where can they let us know on a more official level?
You can let us know. Probably easiest way is to rate and review in iTunes or whatever podcatching service you use. 5-star reviews are probably the best way that we can get more attention to the show, get more eyes and ears on the product. But it's also where you can weigh in and let us know what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong, and, well, what we should never, ever do again. The only way that we can make this show better is finding out what we need to change, and at the end of the day, we just want to make the kind of show that you good people at home want to listen to.
Exactly. So with that, are there any parting words, Andrew, for our listeners?
Why, yes, Dave, there are. Remember, everybody, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Unless that monotony is something you say into the mirror 5 times, and then, you know, I don't know what the embodiment of monotony is, but it'll be something. Bye.